It is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done them better. The credit belongs to the man who is actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs, and when comes short again and again, because there is no effort without error and shortcoming, but who does actually strive to do the deeds, who knows great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at the best knows in the end the triumph of high achievement, and who at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly, so that his place shall never be with those cold and timid souls who neither know victory nor defeat. Good morning, my beloved friends. This excerpt may sound familiar to some of you. It is often referred to as the man in the arena, quote, and is part of a larger speech given by President Theodore Roosevelt, 35 pages to be exact, in 1910 at the University of Paris, the Sorbonne in France. It's been used in many, many ways over the years in politics and sports, and most recently by social researcher and writer and faithful Episcopalian, Brené Brown. She quoted it first in her 2012 TED Talk, Listening to Shame, that went viral on the internet, and then served as the inspiration and title for her book, Daring Greatly. If you were with us here at Trinity during the season of Lent, the 5 weeks leading up to Easter, you may remember that we preached a sermon series integrating scripture and Brené Brown's lessons from her more recent book, Braving the Wilderness, The Quest for True Belonging and the Courage to Stand Alone. So in this book in 2012, Daring Greatly, Brown says that much of what she has dedicated her professional, personal, emotional, and spiritual life is articulated in this quote you just heard in 3 very specific ways. First, courage. How important it is to find ways to live her life in the arena, and to do so requires courage. Second, vulnerability. How essential it is to remember that living in the arena requires vulnerability, which means life is not about winning or losing, but about showing up fully and a willingness to be seen even when we don't have all the answers. And finally, what she calls the inescapability of butt kicking. You heard me. Butt kicking. How certain it is that when we show up fully in the arena, we will, without a doubt, get our butts kicked. Remember, this is the same person who wrote she believes that praying and cussing are not 2 mutually exclusive activities. In other words, there are 2 requirements and 1 unavoidable reality to this way of being in the world. Once we are in the arena of our lives, showing up fully, cultivating courage, learning to get up when we fall again and again, we will need to learn how to respond to critics in the bleachers. There will always be those who simply sit in the bleachers of our life and are ready to sling mud at us at any opportunity. Those who will never risk anything personally, but will criticize everything all the same. She has a name and a strategy for them, and I think both are helpful insights for us as well. She calls these folks Twitter thugs. And whenever we find ourselves sitting in the bleachers doing the same, it often describes us as well. And in the end, she finds their words and their way of being in the world not only unhelpful, but often hurtful, and sometimes even powerful enough to cause us doubt and shame and undermining the courage we need to move forward in life, engaging the struggles we claim as worthy and necessary. She says, and I quote, "If you are not in the arena, also getting your butt kicked, I am simply not interested in your feedback." Now that might sound a bit harsh, but hold on to that thought and let's turn to the gospel for just a moment. In this morning's gospel lesson, we have two perhaps seemingly disconnected pieces of a story. First, what some scholars call the rejection of Jesus in his hometown, and then immediately followed by the calling and sending of the 12 disciples. To begin with, I think it's worth noting that I think it was rather brave of the gospel writer of Mark to include this story at all. Other storytellers might have omitted this story, fearing it could, well, make Jesus look kind of bad and kind of weak. So why did he include it? Why put Jesus in such a vulnerable place? He didn't have to tell this story, or did he? I think it was intentional and necessary so that we could see his humanity through his vulnerability. And when read through the lens of our daring greatly quote, it might offer a powerful invitation for us today. Jesus goes back home, and, well, he doesn't get a very warm welcome, does he? This is where we get that phrase, "never a prophet in your own land." Rather than recognizing the power of his ministry to date, he is scoffed at and scorned by the people who knew him best. They see nothing good when they look at this boy they knew growing up. The gospel writer of Mark shares that because of their lack of belief, Jesus can do no acts of power. Why is that? Is this simply the response of what we might call Twitter thugs? Perhaps. All they see is a hometown boy who's made it big and has, as my grandma would say, grown too big for his britches. They are either unable or unwilling to celebrate what is good and holy and powerful in his ministry. Trapped in their comparisons and complaints, they are definitely not in the arena with Jesus and are not remotely interested in receiving his blessing, let alone sharing in his ministry. Even Jesus seems to be flustered by their reaction. But rather than engage their negativity, he moves on and he stays focused on his call. This feels like a turning point to me in the narrative. While the text does not tell us about it, I wonder what it took for Jesus to simply hear their critique and then choose to move forward. I don't know about you, but I struggle with feeling rejected at times. And yet, time and time again, Jesus is rejected. Jesus makes a different choice. He seems laser focused on the good and the holy and cultivates the courage through his vulnerability and resolves to keep moving forward. Jesus was rejected by those who knew, and at times we will be too. But through this narrative, he seems to be saying, so what? So what that people will reject you? Being rejected may always be a possibility, but it does not define your reality, or in the end, the choice that we can make. And this is why I am so grateful for the second part of this morning's lesson. In the second half of today's story, Jesus chooses and sends the disciples out two by two. This is when and how Jesus equips and commissions his disciples to carry on his ministry. They are, for the first time, called to actually be active partners in his ministry. And it is here that we too, I think, are invited to do the same. So how does he send them out? And what does he charge them to do? His instructions depend on three things: mutuality, vulnerability, and courage. They are to go out in pairs, still good advice to this very day, don't go alone, and to take nothing for their journey, but rather to rely on the kindness and hospitality of strangers. And while some will receive them and be blessed, others will refuse their ministry and blessing. And here is where even Jesus seems to recognize the reality and inevitability of Twitter thugs. Shaking dust off one's feet. This is a phrase that is sometimes interpreted as a matter of cursing those who reject you. But I want to suggest a way to reframe this idea that I think might be more helpful, though I warn you, it will take more courage. Shaking the dust off one's feet might be another way of rejecting the voice of the Twitter thug. Not necessarily the person, but the way they are responding to us when we are face planted down in the mud in the middle of the arena. Shaking the dust off one's feet might be another way of saying, I will not be distracted by your unhelpful commentary if you continue to sit in the bleachers and remain unengaged in the struggle. That kind of response takes humility and courage because we are relying on God's grace to show us the work ahead. And we will be wrong at times, and we will fail in our efforts. But to do nothing, anything less, to me, feels like a royal waste of time. There are so many ways I think we get distracted by the Twitter thugs in our life these days, large and small, both here, right here in this community, and outside those doors, and in the world. In a heartbeat, I bet you can name those voices right now in your life who could be labeled a Twitter thug. And I'm sorry that there are so many that I could label in mine. But today, standing in front of you, I want to take a pledge, and I invite you to consider doing the same. To face into the power that we have given over to Twitter thugs to rule the narrative. And instead, try to find that hard way to separate out who they are from the voices that they are lodging at us. It is what Jesus does whenever he is rejected, and in the end, why he had to make his way to the cross. Hateful, unengaged, critical, self-serving voices are dominating our public narrative these days. They are creating a cacophony of sound right now that at times seems to drown out our voice of hopefulness. It is time to call out the power of moving into the arena together and to claim that in order to reject the Twitter thugs in our lives whenever and wherever they show up. Whatever we believe individually, surely we are in need of reclaiming a civil discourse in order to start hearing each other again and seeing each other as the beautiful children of God that each of us truly are at our core. And whenever we ourselves find the voice of the Twitter thug coming up inside of us, and I tell you, I have a big one inside of me, I'm going to try to remember that I have another choice as well. At times, all of us can be just like the people of the town of Nazareth. We can subscribe to a myth of scarcity and engage in a kind of competition that at its core depends on winners and losers, rather than the healing and the wholeness of all of creation. As I close this morning, I'm reminded of the words written by the 19th century Swiss poet and moral theologian and philosopher Henri Valdi-Amiel. He reminds us of the urgency, the fragility, and the sacredness of the gift we have been entrusted with in each of our precious lives. He writes, "Life is short. and we do not have much time to gladden the hearts of those who travel with us. So be swift to love and make haste to be kind. So let's be swift, my friends, and let's stop wasting this precious time. Instead, let's step into the arena of God's kingdom together to spend ourselves in a worthy cause. So in the end, we will share in the triumph of God's inclusive, radical, transformative love. And when we fail along the way, as surely we will nonetheless fail while daring greatly together. May it be so.